Chapter 6
Janet, the receptionist at Hillview Manor, smiled at me this time when I walked through the front door. It helped that I had called ahead to get Mr. Iverson's eating and napping schedule. She told me to show up around 2 o'clock, which I did on the dot, anticipating the wall of mentholatum odor that hit me as I stepped through the door. The old woman with the crooked wig still kept her vigil at the entrance, paying no attention to me as I walked by her. Before I left my apartment, I settled Jeremy on the couch, started his movie, and showed him again which buttons to push on the remote and which ones to avoid. If all went well, and Iverson agreed to be my subject, I might have just enough time to get some background for my assignment. "Hi, Joe." Janet stood up and walked out from behind her reception desk. "Is my timing good?" I asked.
"As good as it's going to be. Mr. Iverson had a rough night last night. Pancreatic cancer is a terrible thing."
"Is he okay to..."
"He's fine now, probably a little tired. The pain in his belly flares up sometimes, and we have to sedate him just to give him a few hours' rest."
"Isn't he getting radiation or chemo or something?"
"He could, I guess, but it won't do any good at this point. The most that chemo might do is prolong the inevitable. He said he doesn't want that. I don't blame him."
Janet walked me to the lounge area, pointing to a man in a wheelchair sitting alone in front of one of the large windows that line the back of the building.
"He sits there every day staring out that window, looking at God knows what, since there ain't nothing to see. He just sits there. Mrs. Lorngren thinks he's mesmerized by a view with no metal bars blocking the way."
I half expected Carl Iverson to be a monster strapped to his wheelchair with leather belts for the protection of the residents around him, or to have the cold, piercing eyes of a madman capable of doing great evil, or to have the demanding presence of an infamous villain. But I found none of that. Carl Iverson should have been in his mid-60s, if I did the math right. But as I looked at this man, I thought that Janet made a mistake and brought me to the wrong person. A few thin wisps of long gray hair dangled from the crown of his head. Sharp bones poked against gaunt cheeks. Thin skin, tinted yellow with jaundice, covered a neck so skinny and shriveled that I was sure I could have closed a single hand completely around it.
He had a serious scar crossing the carotid artery on his neck, and cadaverous forearms, their tendons prominent against the bone in the absence of any muscle or fat. I half believed that I could hold his arm up like a child might hold a leaf up to the sunlight and see every vein and capillary that ran through it. If I had not known better, I would have put his age closer to 80.
"Stage 4, Janet said. "It's about as bad as it gets. We'll try to make him comfortable, but there's only so much we can do. He can have morphine, but he fights it. Says he'd rather have the pain and be able to think clearly."
"How long's he got?"
"If he makes it to Christmas, I'll lose a bet," she said. "I sometimes feel sorry for him, but then I remember who he is. What he did. And I think about that girl he killed and everything she missed out on. Boyfriends, love, getting married and having a family of her own. Her kids would have been about your age if he hadn't killed her. I think about those things whenever I start feeling sorry for him."
The phone rang, pulling Janet back to the reception desk. I waited for a minute or two, hoping she would come back and provide the introduction. When she didn't return, I cautiously approached what little remained of the murderer, Carl Iverson.
"Mr. Iverson?" I said.
"Yes?"
He turned his attention away from a nut hatch he'd been watching scamper down the trunk of a dead jack pine outside the window.
"I'm Joe Talbert," I said. "I think Mrs. Lorngren told you I was coming?"
"Ah, my visitor has arrived," Carl said, speaking in a half-whisper, breaking his sentence in half with a wheezing inhale.
He nodded his head toward an armchair nearby. I sat.
"So you're the scholar?"
"Nah," I said. "Not a scholar, just a student."
"Lorngren tells me..."
He shut his eyes tightly to let a wave of pain pass.
"She tells me you want to write my story."
"I have to write a biography for my English class."
"So..."
he said, raising an eyebrow, leaning toward me, his face dead serious.
The most obvious question is, why me? How do I come to receive such an honor?
I find your story compelling. I said the first thing that came to my mind, the words echoing with insincerity.
Compelling? In what way?
It's not every day you meet it. I stopped myself, looking for a polite way to end the sentence. A murderer? A rapist of children? That was way too harsh. A person who's been in prison, I said.
You're pulling your punches, Joe,
he said, sowing his words in a careful, steady pace so as to avoid having to stop to catch his breath. Sir?
You're not interested in me because I spent time in prison. You're interested because of the Hagen murder. That's why you're talking to me. You can say it. It's going to help with the grade, right?
The thought did cross my mind, I said. That kind of thing, killing someone, I mean, well, you don't come across that every day.
Probably more often than you think, he said. There's probably 10 or 15 people in this very building who have killed.
You think there are 10 other murderers in this building besides you? I said.
Are you talking about killing or murdering?
Is there a difference? Mr. Iverson looked out the window as he pondered the question, not so much looking for the answer as contemplating whether to tell it to me. I watched the tiny muscles in his jaw tighten a couple times before he answered.
Yes, he said. There is a difference. I've done both. I've killed, and I've murdered.
What's the difference?
It's the difference between hoping that the sun rises and hoping that it doesn't.
I don't understand, I said. What's that mean?
Of course you don't understand, he said. How could you? You're just a kid, a college pup blowing his daddy's money on beer and girls, trying to keep a passing grade so you can avoid getting a job for another few years. You probably have no greater care in the world than whether you'll have a date by Saturday.
The vigor of this emaciated old man caught me off guard, and frankly, it pissed me off. I thought about Jeremy back at my apartment, a TV remote click away from crisis. I thought about my mother in jail, begging for my help on the inhale and cursing my birth on the exhale. I thought about the thin edge that I walked between being able to afford college and not, and I wanted to dump that dusty, judgmental prick out of his wheelchair. I felt anger rising in my chest, but I took a deep breath, as I had learned to do whenever I became frustrated with Jeremy, and I let it pass.
You know nothing about me, I said. You don't know where I've been, or what I have to deal with. You don't know the shit I've had to wade through to get here.
Whether or not you tell me your story is up to you, that's your prerogative, but don't presume to judge me. I fought against the urge to stand up and walk out, holding onto the arm of the chair to keep me in my seat. Iverson glanced down at my white-knuckled grip, then at my eyes. A hint of a smile more subtle than a single flake of snow crossed his face, and his eyes nodded approval.
That's good, he said.
What's good?
That you understand how wrong it is to judge someone before you know their whole story.
I saw the lesson he wanted me to learn, but I was far too angry to respond. He continued,
I could have told my story to any number of people. I used to get letters in prison from people wanting to turn my life into something they could make money from. I never responded because I knew that I could give 100 authors the same information, and they would write 100 different stories. So if I'm going to tell you my story, if I tell you the truth about everything, then I need to know who you are. That you're not just some punk in this for an easy grade. That you will be honest with me, and be fair about how you tell my story.
You understand, I said, this is just a homework assignment. No one's going to read it except my teacher.
Do you know how many hours are in a month?
Carl asked, apropos of nothing. I'm sure I could figure it out.
There's 720 hours in the month of November. October and December each have 744.
Okay, I said, hoping he would explain his tangent. You see, Joe, I can count my life in hours. If I'm going to spend some of those hours on you, I need to know that you're worth my time.
I hadn't considered that point. Janet thought Carl would be dead by Christmas. With just a week remaining in September, that would give Carl 3 months to live. I did the rough math in my head and understood. If Janet was right, then Carl Iverson had less than 3,000 hours of life left to live.
I guess that makes sense, I said.
So what I'm saying is this. I'll be truthful with you. I'll answer any question you put to me. I'll be that proverbial open book. But I need to know that you are not wasting my limited time.
You have to be honest with me as well. That's all that I ask. Can you do that?
I thought about it for a moment. You'll be absolutely honest about everything?
Absolutely honest.
Carl held out his hand to shake mine, to seal the agreement, and I took it. I could feel the bones of Carl's hand knocking around under his thin skin as if I were gripping a bag of marbles.
So, Carl asked, why aren't you doing a story on your mom or dad?
Let's just say my mom is less than reliable.
Carl stared, waiting for me to continue.
Honestly, remember?
He said. Okay, honestly? Right now my mother is in a detox center in Austin. She should be getting out tomorrow, and then she'll sit in jail until her first appearance in court on DUI charges.
Well, she sounds like she has a story to tell.
I won't be telling it,
I said. Mr. Iverson nodded his understanding.
What about your dad?
Never met him.
Grandparents?
My grandma on my mom's side died when mom was a teenager. My grandpa died when I was 11.
How'd he die?
Carl asked the question with no more forethought than you give to a yawn, but he had stumbled onto my deepest wound. He had opened the door to a conversation that I refused to have, even with myself.
This isn't about me, I said, the sharp tone in my voice cutting a swath between Mr. Iverson and me. And this isn't about my grandpa. It's about you. I'm here to get your story, remember?
Carl leaned back in his chair and considered me while I tried to wash my face of all expression. I didn't want him to see the guilt in my eyes or the anger in my clenched jaw.
Okay,
he said.
I didn't mean to touch a nerve.
No nerve, I said. You didn't touch any nerve.
I tried to act as if my reaction had been nothing more than mild impatience. Then I lobbed a question at him to change the subject.
So, Mr. Iverson, let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Because you only have a few months to live, why would you agree to spend it talking to me? Carl adjusted himself in his chair, gazing out the window at the drying towels and the barbecue grills littering the apartment balconies across the way. I could see his index finger stroking the arm of his wheelchair. It reminded me of how Jeremy strokes his knuckles when he is anxious.
Joe,
he said finally,
do you know what a dying declaration is?
I didn't, although I gave it a shot. It's a declaration made by someone who is dying?
It is a term of law,
he said.
If a man whispers the name of his killer and then dies, it's considered good evidence because there's a belief, an understanding, that a person who is dying would not want to die with a lie upon his lips. No sin could be greater than a sin that cannot be rectified, the sin you never get to confess. So this conversation with you, this is my dying declaration. I don't care if anybody reads what you write. I don't even care if you write it down at all.
Carl pursed his lips, his stare searching for something far beyond the immediate scenery, a slight quiver in his words.
I have to say the words out loud. I have to tell someone the truth about what happened all those years ago. I have to tell someone the truth about what I did.
Chapter 7. That evening, my head pulsed with waves of excitement. I had secured a tragic subject for my biography assignment and, to top the evening off,
I had a dinner date with Lila Nash. Okay, not a date, but I had a girl coming over to my home to share a meal with me. This had never happened before. When it came to dating, I always stuck to restaurants. I had never cooked for a girl or served a girl a meal in my home. I had come close once, but like many of my plans back in my high school days, it came to ruin. Somewhere in my adolescence, I discovered that I was neither handsome nor ugly. I fell in that vast ocean of so-so guys that made up the background of the picture. I was the guy that you agree to go to homecoming with after you found out that the guy you really wanted had already asked another girl. I was okay with that. In fact, I think that good looks would have been wasted on me. Don't get me wrong, I had my share of dates in high school, but by design, I never dated anyone for more than a couple months. Except Phyllis. Phyllis was my first girlfriend. She had curly brown hair that sprayed out from her head like the tentacles of a sea anemone. I thought she looked peculiar until the day we shared our first kiss. After that, her hair struck me as daring and avant-garde. We were high school freshmen, following the well-worn path of juvenile courtship, testing boundaries, hiding behind corners to steal a kiss, holding hands under the table in the cafeteria, all the things that seemed so wonderfully exciting to me. Then one day she insisted that I introduce her to my mother.
"Are you ashamed of me?" Phyllis asked. "Am I just someone you mess around with when it's convenient?"
Try as I might, I could not convince her that my intentions were honorable unless I brought her to my house for a formal introduction. Looking back now, I should have simply broken up with her and let her think I was a jerk. I told my mother that I would be bringing Phyllis by after school that day. I talked about the visit as often as I could that morning, hoping to get across to my mother that she needed to be on her best behavior for that 1 hour of that one day. All she had to do was be cordial, sober, and normal for 1 hour. Sometimes I ask too much. As we strolled up the front walk, I could smell food, or the remains of food, burning in the kitchen. Phyllis had been smiling for the entire walk from school to my house, nervously folding her fingers together as we got closer. I stopped at the front door, hearing my mother scream at some guy named Kevin. I didn't know any Kevin.
"God damn it, Kevin! I can't pay you right now."
I could hear the slur in her words. "That's just great," a male voice hollered back. "I bend over backward to help you out, and when I need the money, you fuck me over."
"It's not my fault you can't keep a job," Mom yelled. "Don't be blaming me."
"No, but it's your fault I got no money," he said. "I ain't got no retard kid to pay my bills like you do. You owe me $100. I know you get welfare or some shit for that kid. Just pay me out of that."
"Fuck you, you piece of shit. Get out of my house."
"Where's my money?"
"You'll get your fucking money. Now get out."
"When? When do I get the money?"
"Get out. My kid's coming home with some little skank, and I need to get ready."
"When do I get my money?"
"Get out before I call the cops and tell them you're driving without a license again, you fucking bitch."
Kevin slammed his way out the back door about the same time that the smoke detector shrieked to life, fed by the burning food in the kitchen. I looked at Phyllis and saw that she had folded close the shutters of her brain, albeit too late to block out the experience that would surely be the focus of some future therapy sessions. I wanted to apologize, to explain, or better yet, to disappear, slip through the cracks between the porch planks. Instead, I turned Phyllis around by her shoulders, walked her to the corner, and said my last goodbye to her. The following day at school, she made a point of avoiding me in the halls, which was fine by me because I would have avoided her anyway. After that, I never dated any girl for more than 2 months. I couldn't endure the humiliation of bringing another girl home to my mother. I thought of Phyllis as I cooked the noodles for my dinner with Lila. For the first time in my life, I would bring a girl home and not worry about what would meet me at the door. But then again, I wasn't bringing a girl home. This wasn't a date, despite the amount of time I spent getting ready, combing my hair just so, applying a little extra deodorant and a tiny hint of cologne, picking out clothes that said both, "Look at me," and "I don't care." I even made Jeremy take a shower in my bathroom across the hall. All this effort for a girl who threw a cold shoulder at me with the force of a middle linebacker. But damn, she was cute. Lila arrived at 7, wearing the same jeans and sweater that she'd worn that morning when she left for class. She said hello, glanced around the kitchen to see that I had started the water boiling,
and then went to Jeremy, who was sitting on the couch.
"What's the movie tonight, handsome?" she said.
Jeremy blushed slightly.
"Maybe Pirates of the Caribbean," he said.
"Perfect,"
she smiled.
"I love that movie."
Jeremy smiled his best goofy smile as he pointed the remote at the television, and Lila pushed the button to start the movie. I felt a strange jealousy watching Jeremy and Lila on my couch, but that was exactly what I had asked for. I used Jeremy to coax Lila to my home, and she came to see him, not me. I turned back my spaghetti noodles, glancing over at Lila every now and again to see her attention split between the television and a stack of my homework papers on the coffee table.
"Are you researching the war in El Salvador?" she asked.
"The war in El Salvador?" I said, looking over my shoulder. She was reading the newspaper article I'd copied at the library.
"You have an article about the signing of a peace treaty between El Salvador and Honduras."
"Oh, that," I said. "No, look at the column below that."
"The one about the girl?" she said.
"Yeah, I am interviewing the guy who killed her." She went silent for a moment as she read each of the articles I had copied at the library. I watched her face wince as she covered those parts of the story that expounded upon the more gruesome details of Crystal Hagen's death. I stirred the pasta and waited patiently for her response. Then she said,
"You're kidding, right?"
"What?" She flipped through the articles again.
"You're interviewing this psychopath?"
"What's wrong with that?" I asked.
"Everything,"
Lila said.
"It amazes me how prison scumbags can sucker people into paying them attention. I knew this girl who got engaged to some creep in prison. She swore he was innocent. Wrongfully convicted. Waited for him for 2 years until he got released. 6 months later, he was back in prison after he beat the crap out of her."
"Carl's not in prison," I said with a sheepish shrug.
"He's not in prison? How could he not be in prison after what he did to that girl?"
"He's dying of cancer at a nursing home. He only has a few months," I said.
"And you're interviewing him because..."
"I'm writing his biography."
"You're writing his story?"
she said, with more than a hint of condemnation. "It's for my English class," I said almost as an apology.
"You're giving him notoriety."
"It's an English class," I said. "One teacher and maybe 25 students. I'd hardly call that notoriety."
Lila put the papers back down on my table. She looked at Jeremy and lowered her voice. "It doesn't matter that it's only a college class. You should do a story on the girl he killed, or the girls he would have killed if he hadn't gone to prison. They deserve the attention, not him. He should be disposed of quietly. No grave marker, no eulogy, no memory of the man. When you write down his life story, you're creating a marker that shouldn't exist."
"Don't hold back," I said. "Tell me what you really think." I pulled a thread of spaghetti from the boiling water and threw it at the refrigerator. It bounced off the fridge door and fell to the floor.
"What the hell are you doing?"
she asked, looking at the noodle on the floor. "Testing the spaghetti," I said, glad to be on a different topic. "By flinging it around the kitchen?" "If it sticks to the refrigerator, it's done." I bent down and picked the spaghetti strand off the floor and tossed it into the garbage. And the spaghetti isn't quite done yet. When I left Hillview earlier that day, I felt good about my project. Iverson had promised to tell me the truth about the death of Crystal Hagen. I would be his confessor. I couldn't wait for my dinner with Lila to tell her about Carl. In my imagination, at least, Lila would be riveted by what I was doing, sharing my excitement, wanting to know all about Carl. After seeing her reaction now, all I wanted to do was avoid that subject for the rest of the evening.
"Did he tell you what he did? Or is he telling you he was framed?" she asked.
"He hasn't said a thing about it yet." I pulled 3 plates from the cupboard and walked them to the coffee table in the living room, where we would be eating. Lila got up and grabbed some glasses from the same cupboard and followed me. I cleaned my backpack, my notes, and the newspaper articles off the coffee table.
"We haven't gotten to that point yet," I said.
"So far, he's told me about growing up in South St. Paul, an only child. Let's see. His father managed a hardware store, and his mom..." I paged through my memory. "Worked at a deli in downtown St. Paul." "So when you write this guy's story, you're simply going to write down whatever he tells you to?"
Lila placed the glasses on the table by the plates. I also have to get a couple of secondary sources, I said, walking back to the kitchen. But when it comes to what he did...
And by what he did, you mean raping and killing a 14-year-old girl and burning her dead body?
Lila added. Yeah, that. When it comes to that, there are no other sources. I have to write what he tells me.
So he can feed you a line of bull, and you'd tell that story?
He's already done his time. Why would he lie?
Why wouldn't he lie?
Lila said, with an edge of incredulity.
She stood at the end of the kitchen counter, her hands flat on the formica, her arms stiff, her fingers spread.
Put yourself in his shoes. He rapes some poor girl, murders her, spends his time in prison telling every cellmate, guard, and lawyer who cares to listen to him that he's innocent. He's not going to quit now. Do you really think that he's going to admit that he killed that girl?
But he's dying, I said, flinging another spaghetti strand at the refrigerator. It stuck.
That proves my point, not yours, Lila said, with the air of a practiced debater. He gets you to write your little article, biography, whatever. And now he has a written account out there in academia painting him as the victim.
He wants to give me his dying declaration, I said, pouring the spaghetti into the strainer to rinse it.
He wants to give you his what?
His dying declaration, that's what he called it. It's a statement that's true because you don't want to die with a lie on your lips.
As opposed to dying with a murderer under your belt?
She said.
You see the irony, don't you?
It's not the same thing, I said.
I had no argument as to why it wasn't the same thing. I couldn't hack my way past her logic. Every turn presented another blocked path, so I signaled my defeat by carrying the noodles to the coffee table and dishing them onto the plates. Lila picked up the pan of marinara sauce and followed me. As she started to pour the sauce, she stood up and grinned like the Grinch on Christmas Eve.
Oh, do I have an idea, she said.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
A jury convicted him, right?
Yeah.
Which means he had a trial.
I assume so, I said.
You can look at his file from the trial. That'll tell you exactly what happened. It'll have all the evidence, not just his version.
His file? Can I do that?
My aunt's a paralegal at a law firm in St. Cloud. She'll know.
Lila pulled her cell phone from her pocket and scrolled through her contacts until she found her aunt's number. I handed Jeremy a paper towel to use as a napkin so that he could start eating, and then I listened to Lila's end of the conversation.
So the file belongs to the client, not the lawyer? She said.
How do I find that out?
Will they still have it? Can you email that to me?
Perfect. Thanks a bunch. I gotta run.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Lila hung up her phone. It's easy, Lila said, turning to me. His old attorney will have the file.
It's been 30 years, I said. But it's a murder case, so my aunt said they should still have it.
I picked up the newspaper articles, paging through them until I came across the name of the attorney.
His name was John Peterson, I said. He was a public defender out of Minneapolis.
There you go, she said.
But how do we get it from the lawyer?
That's the beauty, she said. The file doesn't belong to the lawyer. It belongs to Carl Iverson.
It's Carl's file, and the lawyer has to let him have it.
My aunt's going to email me a form that he can sign requesting the file, and they have to give it to him or whoever he sends over to get it.
So all I have to do is get Carl to sign this form?
He'll have to sign it, she said. If he doesn't sign, then you know that he's full of crap. Either he signs it, or he's nothing more than a lying, murdering bastard who wants to keep you in the dark about what he really did.
Chapter 8
I'd seen my mom wake up in the morning with the remnants of her previous night's binge still smeared in her hair. I'd seen her stumble into the apartment cross-eyed drunk with her shoes in one hand and wadded up undergarments in the other. But I'd never seen her look as pathetic as she did when she came shuffling into the Mower County Courthouse, wearing her jail orange jumpsuit with her wrists in handcuffs and shackles on her ankles. 3 days of no makeup and no showering brought out the burlap in her skin. Her blonde hair with its dark brown roots hung heavy with dandruff and greasy buildup. Her shoulders slumped forward as though the cuffs on her wrists weighed her down.
I had dropped Jeremy off at Mom's apartment before heading to the courthouse to wait for her first appearance. She entered with three other people, also dressed in orange. When she saw me, she waved for me to come up to the wooden railing, her on one side, standing beside the attorney's table with its comfy chairs, and me in the gallery, with its wooden church pews for seating. A bailiff held out a hand as I approached her, a signal to not get close enough to pass weapons or other such contraband to the people in orange.
"You need to bail me out," Mom said in a frantic whisper.
Up close, I could see that the stress of her incarceration had hung deep crescent bags of exhaustion under her bloodshot eyes. She looked as if she hadn't slept in days.
"How much are you talking about?" I said. "The jailer said I'll probably need $3,000 to bail out, else I gotta stay in jail."
"$3,000?" I said. "I need that money for school."
"I can't take jail, Joey."
My mother started to cry.
"It's full of crazy people. They stay up all night yelling. I can't sleep. I'm going crazy, too. Don't make me go back there, please, Joey."
I opened my mouth to speak, but nothing came out. I felt sorry for her. I mean, this was my mother, the woman who gave me life. But if I gave her $3,000, I would run out of money midway through my next semester. My thoughts of staying in school were colliding with the vision of my mother in her most desperate hour. I wasn't able to speak. No matter what I said, it would be wrong. I was rescued from my dilemma when a couple of women entered the court through a door behind the judge's bench, and the bailiff called for everyone to rise. I took a deep breath, thankful for the interruption. The judge entered and instructed everyone to sit down, and the bailiff escorted my mother to a seat in the jury box to sit with the other folks in orange. As the clerk called what she referred to as the in-custodies up to the bench, I listened to the dialogue that went back and forth between the judge and the attorney, a female public defender handling all four defendants. It reminded me of a Catholic funeral mass I had attended when one of my high school coaches died. The litany had been spoken by the priest and the parishioners so many times that the rote presentation seemed toneless to us outsiders. The judge said, "Is your name... Do you live at... Do you understand your rights? Counsel, does your client understand the charges?"
"Yes, Your Honor, and we waive any further reading of the complaint."
"How do you wish to proceed?"
"Your Honor, we waive the Rule 8 hearing, ask that my client be released on his personal recognizance."
The judge would then set bail, giving each inmate the choice between paying a higher bail amount with no conditions, or paying lower bail, or no bail at all, provided that they agree to abide by certain conditions set by the judge. When Mom took her turn before the judge, they went through the same back and forth, with the judge setting bail at $3,000, but then he continued with the second option. "Ms. Nelson, you can pay the $3,000, or you can be released on your personal promise to appear at all future hearings, as well as the following conditions. Keep in contact with your attorney, remain law-abiding, no possession or consumption of alcohol, and be hooked up to an alcohol monitoring bracelet. Any use of alcohol will bring you right back to jail. Do you understand those conditions?"
"Yes, Your Honor," my mother said,
looking absolutely Dickensian in her role as the pitiful soul. "That's all," the judge said. Mom shuffled back to the line of people in orange, all of whom now stood up and started moving in chain gang fashion toward the door that would lead them back to the jail. As she passed, Mom looked at me with a glare that would have been the envy of Medusa.
"Come down to the jail and bail me out," she whispered.
"But Mom, the judge just said..."
"Don't argue with me,"
she hissed as she left the courtroom. "And she's back," I muttered under my breath. I walked out of court, pausing on the sidewalk to ponder which way to turn, left to the jail and my mother, or right to my car. The judge said she could leave. I heard him. All she had to do was not drink. A bad feeling crept through my veins, like poison from a snake bite. I wrestled with my decision, eventually turning left, overruling my urge to run. Entering the jail, I gave my driver's license to a lady behind bulletproof glass, who directed me to a small room, where another glass window separated me from the cubicle where they would bring my mother. A couple minutes later, they brought my mother to the cubicle, now free of her handcuffs and shackles. She sat in a chair on the other side of the glass, picking up a black phone on the wall. I did the same thing, grimacing as I drew the phone up to my face, imagining the multitudes of unfortunates who had breathed into that receiver before me. It felt sticky.
Did you pay the bail?
You don't need me to pay bail. You can get out on your own. The judge said so.
He said I could get out if I did that monitor thing. I'm not doing no damn monitor.
But you can get out for free. You just can't drink.
I ain't doing no damn monitor,
she said.
You have enough money. You can help me out for once in your life. I can't take another minute in here.
Mom, I barely have enough to make through the semester. I can't.
I'll pay you back, for Christ's sake.
Now we were getting into our own litany. When I turned 16, I got my first job changing oil at a garage in town. When I spent my first paycheck on clothes and a skateboard, Mom threw a fit so fierce that the upstairs neighbors called the landlord and the cops. After she settled down, she forced me to open a savings account, and, because a 16-year-old can't open an account without a parent, they put her name on it as well. For the next 2 years, she borrowed money from that account whenever she ran light on the rent or her car needed fixing, always with the empty promise that she'd pay me back, but never doing so. The day I turned 18, I opened my own account in my name alone. Without direct access to my money, she had to switch her tactic, moving from theft to blackmail, because, after all, living in her house and eating her food entitled her to bleed my account of hundreds of dollars. So I started skimming a little off the top each week, hiding the money in a can under the insulation in the attic. My coffee can college fund. Mom always suspected that I hid money, but she could never prove it, and she never found it. In her mind, the few grand that I secreted away had grown to 10 times what actually lay beneath the insulation. Add that to my student loans and the pittance I got in grant money, and in my mother's mind, my cash had grown to a small fortune. "Can't we get a bail bondsman?" I asked. "Then you don't have to pay the full $3,000.
"Don't you think I thought of that? You think I'm stupid? I got no collateral. They won't talk to me without collateral."
Her words cut with an edge I knew well, her mean streak showing through as clear as the dark roots that line the part in her hair. I decided to come back hard myself.
"I can't bail you out, Mom. I can't. If I give you $3,000, I can't afford to go to college next semester. There's just no way to do it."
"Well, then," she leaned back in the plastic chair,
"you'll have to take care of Jeremy while I'm in here, because I'm not going on no damn monitor."
And there it was, the final card in her hand, proving that she had the royal flush. She had beaten me. I could try bluffing and say that I would leave Jeremy in Austin, but that bluff was naked, and my mother knew it. She stared at me with the conviction of a falling boulder, her eyes calm, level, my eyes twitching with anger.
How could I take care of Jeremy? When I left him alone for a couple hours, he needed to be rescued by Lila.
I had gone to college to get away from all this crap. Now here she was, pulling me back, forcing me to choose between my college education and my brother. I wanted to reach through that reinforced glass and choke her.
"I can't believe how selfish you are," she said. "I told you I'd pay you back."
I pulled my checkbook out of my back pocket and started writing the check as a current of rage passed through me. I smiled slightly as I imagined filling out the entire check, then holding it up to the thick glass that separated us and tearing it to shreds. But deep down, I knew the truth. I needed her. Not as a son needs a mother, but as a sinner needs the devil. I needed a scapegoat, someone I could point at and say, "You're responsible for this, not me." I needed to feed my delusion that I was not my brother's keeper, that such a duty fell to our mother. I needed a place where I could store Jeremy's life, his care, a box that I could shut tight and tell myself it was where Jeremy belonged, even if I knew deep down that it was all a lie. I needed that thin plausibility to ease my conscience. That would be the only way I could leave Austin. I tore the check out and showed it to my mother. She smiled an empty smile and said,
"Thank you, sweetie. You're an angel."
Chapter 9. I stopped at Hillview on my drive back from Austin, hoping to make some progress on my paper and have Carl sign the release that would allow me to get his file from the public defender's office. I had hoped that a visit with him might distract me from the burn in my chest left there by my mother. I trudged into Hillview, my guilty conscience weighing me down. I felt as if some vacuous force, some inexplicable gravity, was sucking me backward, pulling me to the south, to Austin. I thought that running away to college would get me out of my mother's reach, but I was still too close, too easily plucked from the low branch I had chosen. What would it take to wash my hands of my mother, my brother? What price would I need to pay to leave them behind? At least for today, I thought to myself, the price was $3,000 in bail money. Janet smiled at me from her station behind the reception desk as I passed. I walked to the lounge where residents, most of whom were in wheelchairs, gathered in small clusters like chess pieces in a half-finished game. Carl sat in his usual place, his wheelchair facing the picture window, looking out at the laundry hanging from the balcony rails of the apartment building outside. I stopped short of Carl when I noticed that he had a visitor, a man who looked to be in his mid-60s, with short, peppery hair that spiked and leaned toward the back of his head like pond reeds tipping in a breeze. The man's hand rested on Carl's forearm, and he, too, faced toward the window as they talked. I walked back to the reception desk, found Janet hovering over some paperwork, and asked her about the visitor.
"Oh, that's Virgil," she said. "I can't remember his last name. He's the only visitor Carl's ever had, except for you."
"Are they related?"
"I don't think so. I think they're just friends. Maybe they met in prison. Maybe they were, you know, special friends."
I didn't get the impression Carl swung that way, I said.
"He was in prison for 30 years. That might have been the only swinging he could get."
Janet put her hand to her lips and giggled at the guilty pleasure that had escaped them. I smiled back at her, more in an attempt to stay on her good side than to join in her joke. "Do you think I should go back? I don't want to disturb them if they're..." I trailed off, not sure how to finish the sentence.
"I say go for it," she said. "If you're interrupting, he'll let you know. Carl may be dropping weight like a snowman in a skillet, but don't underestimate him."
I made my way back to Carl, who was now chuckling over something the other man had said. Carl had never smiled in my presence, and the lift it brought to his face shed years. He saw me coming, and his smile withered, as if he were a child being brought in from play.
"There's the pup now," he sighed.
The man with Carl looked up at me with an odd indifference, holding out his hand for me to shake.
"Hey, pup," he said.
"Some folks call me Joe," I said.
"That's right," Carl said. "Joe the writer."
"Actually, it's Joe the college student," I said. "I'm not a writer. It's just an assignment."
"I'm Virgil, the painter," the man said.
"Painter as in Dutch master or Dutch boy?" I asked.
"Mostly Dutch boy," he said. "I paint houses and such, but I do a little canvas work for my own enjoyment."
"Don't let him buffalo you, Joe," Carl said. "Virgil here is a regular Jackson Pollock. Too bad that's when he's trying to paint houses."
Carl and Virgil laughed at that, but I didn't understand the reference. Later I would look up Jackson Pollock on the internet to see his paintings, which resembled something a toddler could have concocted with a plateful of spaghetti and a temper tantrum. I got the joke.
"Mr. Iverson," I started. "Call me Carl," he said.
"Carl, I was hoping I could get you to sign this for me."
"What's that?"
"It's a release. It'll let me see your trial file," I said, hesitantly. "I need 2 collateral sources for the biography."
"Ah, the young pup here doesn't believe I'll be truthful with him," Carl said to Virgil. "He thinks I'll hide the monster that lurks inside of me."
Virgil shook his head and looked away. "I didn't mean any disrespect," I said. "It's just that a friend of mine, well, not so much a friend as a neighbor, thought I could get a better understanding of you if I took a look at the trial stuff."
"Your friend couldn't be more wrong," Virgil said. "If you really want to know the truth about Carl here, the trial's the last place you'd look."
"It's okay, Virg," Carl said. "I don't mind.
Hell, that old file's been collecting dust for 30 years now. Probably doesn't exist anymore.
Virgil leaned forward over his knees, then stood up slowly, using his arms to raise himself off the chair, like a man far older than he appeared to be. Brushing the wrinkles out of his slacks, he grabbed the worn handle of a hickory cane that leaned against the wall near him.
I'm gonna grab some coffee. Want some?
I didn't answer, as I figured he wasn't talking to me. Carl pursed his lips, shook his head no, and Virgil walked away with a practiced but unnatural gait, his right leg bending and snapping straight with mechanical rigidity. I looked closer at the rustle of his pant leg just above his shoe, and saw the unmistakable glint of metal where his ankle should have been. I turned back to Carl, feeling as if I owed him an apology, as if I had called him a liar by wanting to check his story against the file, which is exactly what I planned to do.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ivor. I mean, Carl, I wasn't trying to insult you.
That's all right, Joe, Carl said. Virgil can be a bit overprotective of me. We've known each other a long time.
Are you related? I asked.
Carl thought for a moment and then said,
We're brothers. By fire, not by blood.
His eyes turned back to the window, his gaze lost in a memory that robbed his cheeks of their color. After a moment, he said,
Got a pen?
A pen?
To sign that paper you brought.
I handed Carl the form and a pen and watched him sign the release, his knuckles poking through his skin, his forearms so slight that I could see the pop and contraction in each muscle as he signed. He handed me back the paper and I folded it, sliding it into my pocket.
One thing, though, he said,
looking down at his fingers, which now rested on his lap. He spoke to me without raising his eyes.
When you read that file, you're going to see a lot of things in there. Terrible things that'll make you want to hate me. It sure made the jury hate me. Just keep in mind, that's not my whole story.
I know, I said.
No, you don't.
He said softly, turning his attention back to the colorful towels flapping on the apartment balcony across the way.
You don't know me. Not yet.
I waited for him to finish his thought, but he just stared out the window. I left Carl to his memory, heading to the front door, where Virgil stood waiting for me. He held out his hand, a business card pressed between two of his fingers. I took the card. Virgil Gray Painting. Commercial and residential.
If you want to know about Carl Iverson, he said, you need to talk to me.
Were you in prison with him? Virgil seemed to be on the cusp of aggravation, speaking in a tone that I had heard often in the bars when guys talked about their bad jobs or nagging wives, irritated yet resigned to the circumstances.
He didn't kill that girl. And what you're doing is bullshit.
What? I said.
I know what you're doing,
he said. What am I doing?
I'm telling you, he didn't kill that girl.
You were there?
No, I wasn't there. Don't be a smartass.
It was my turn to be irritated. I had just met this man, and he felt that he knew me well enough to insult me. The way I see it, I said, only two people know what happened. Crystal Hagen and the person who killed her. Anybody else is just saying what they want to believe.
I didn't have to be there to know he didn't kill that girl.
Ted Bundy had people who believed in him, too. I didn't know if that was true, but I thought it sounded good.
He didn't do it,
Virgil snapped. He pointed to the phone number on his card.
You call me. We'll talk.
Chapter 10. I wasted the better part of a week and 8 phone calls trying to pry Carl Iverson's criminal file from the public defender's office. Initially, the receptionist struggled to understand my request, and when she finally did understand, she gave me her opinion that the file had probably been destroyed years ago. Regardless, she said, I have no authority to hand over a murder file to any Tom, Dick, or Harry who asks for it. After that, she simply passed my calls on to the voicemail of Bertha Collins, chief public defender, where my messages seemed to fall into an abyss. On the 5th day of no return call from Collins, I skipped my afternoon classes and caught a bus to downtown Minneapolis. When the receptionist told me that the chief was busy, I told her I would wait and took a seat close enough to her desk that I could hear her as she whispered into her telephone. I read magazines to kill time until she finally whispered to someone, telling them I was lingering. 15 minutes later, she broke down and ushered me into the office of Berthel Collins, a pale-skinned man with a mop of uncombed hair crisscrossing his head and a nose as big around as a ripe persimmon. Berthel smiled at me and shook my hand, as if he wanted to sell me a car.
"So you're the kid that's stalking me,"
he said. "I take it you got my phone messages?" I said. He looked flustered for a second and then motioned me to a chair.
"You gotta understand," he said. "We don't get calls all that often asking us to dig up a 30-year-old file. We store all that stuff off-site."
"But you do still have the file?"
"Oh, yeah," he said. "We have it. We're mandated to keep murder files indefinitely. I had a runner bring it in yesterday." "That's it right there."
He pointed to a banker's box sitting against the wall behind me.
"I hadn't expected that much stuff.
I thought I'd have maybe a binder full of paper, not a box." I calculated the number of hours it would take to read the file and watched as those numbers filled a bucket in my head. I then factored in the homework for my other classes and the tests and the lab projects. I suddenly felt dizzy. How would I ever get this all done? I began to regret my decision to get the file. This was supposed to be a simple English assignment. I reached into my pocket, pulled out the release, and handed it to Mr. Collins. "So can I take that with me then?" I asked.
"Not all of it," he said. "Not yet. We have some files ready to go. We have to call out the notes and work product before we let it go out of this office."
"How long is that going to take?" I shifted in my chair, trying to find a position where the cushion springs didn't grind into my butt cheeks.
"Like I said, we have a couple files ready today," he smiled. "We have an intern working on it. The rest of the files should be ready fairly soon, maybe a week or two."
Collins leaned back in his cushy Georgian wingback chair, which I noticed sat a good 4 inches higher than any other chair in the room, and seemed far more comfortable. I shifted again in my seat, trying to keep blood flowing to my legs.
"What's your interest in this case, anyway?"
he asked, crossing one leg over the other. "Let's just say I have an interest in the life and times of Carl Iverson."
"But why?"
Collins asked with genuine sincerity.
"There wasn't much to this case."
"You know the case?"
"Yeah, I know it,"
he said. "I clerked here that year. It was my third year of law school. Carr's lead attorney, John Peterson, brought me on to do his legal research." Collins paused, looking past me to a blank spot on his wall, recollecting the details of Carl's case.
"I met Carl in jail a few times and sat in the gallery during his trial. It was my first murder case." "Yeah, I remember him. I remember the girl, too. Crystal something or other."
"Hagen."
"That's right, Crystal Hagen."
Collins' face grew cold.
"I still see the pictures. The ones we had in the trial. I'd never seen crime scene photos before. That was my first time. It's not peaceful like you see on TV with their eyes closed, looking like they simply fell asleep. No, it's not like that at all. Her photos were violent and gut-wrenching. To this day, I can still see her."
He shuddered slightly, then continued.
"He could have gotten a deal, you know."
"A deal?"
"A plea bargain. They offered him second-degree murder. He could have been eligible for parole in 8 years. He turned it down. The man's facing a mandatory life sentence if he's convicted of first degree, and he turns down a second-degree plea offer."
"That brings up a question that's been bugging me," I said. "If he gets sentenced to life in prison, how can he ever get paroled?" Collins leaned forward and rubbed the underside of his chin, scratching a day's worth of scruff.
"Life doesn't necessarily mean until you die," he said. "Back in 1980, life in prison meant that you had to do 17 years before being eligible for parole. Later, they changed that to 30 years. They changed it again so that a murder committed during a kidnapping or a rape gets life without possibility of parole. Technically, they convicted Iverson under the old statute, so he was eligible for parole after 17 years, but forget that. Once the legislature made it clear that they want murdering rapists locked up for good, Iverson's prospects for parole pretty much evaporated. To tell you the truth, when I got your call, I looked up Iverson's record on the Department of Corrections website and about fell on the floor when I saw that he was out."
"He's dying of cancer," I said.
"Well, that explains it," he said. "Prison hospice can be problematic."
The corners of his mouth tipped downward, his head nodding in understanding.
"What did Carl say happened on the night Crystal Hagen died?"
Nothing, he said. He said he didn't do it. Said he drank that afternoon until he passed out and couldn't remember a thing. Honestly, he didn't do much to help with his defense. Just kind of sat there and watched the trial like he was watching television.
Did you believe him when he said he was innocent?
It didn't matter what I believed. I was just a law clerk. We put up a good fight. We said that Crystal's boyfriend did it. That was our theory. He was the last to see her alive. He had all the opportunity in the world, and it was a crime of passion. He wanted to screw her. She said no. Things got out of hand. It was a decent theory. A silk purse from a sow's ear, so to speak. But in the end, the jury didn't believe it, and that's all that matters.
There are some people who think he's innocent, I said, thinking of Virgil. Collins lowered his eyes and shook his head, dismissing my comment as if I were some gullible child.
If he didn't do it, then he's one sorry bastard. She was found dead in his shed, he said. They found one of her fingernails on the steps to his back porch.
He tore her fingernail off? I said, shuddering at the thought.
It was a fake fingernail, one of those acrylic things. She had her nails done up for her first homecoming dance a couple weeks earlier. The prosecutor argued that it broke off when he was dragging her dead body to his shed.
Do you believe Carl killed her?
There was no one else around, Collins said. Iverson simply said he didn't do it, but at the same time, he said he was too drunk to remember anything from that night.
It's Occam's razor.
Occam's razor? It's a principle that says all things being equal, the simplest conclusion is usually the correct one. Crimes like murder are rarely tricky, and most murderers are far from clever.
Have you met him yet?
Who, Carl?
Yeah, he signed the release.
Oh, yeah.
Collins furrowed his eyebrows, displeased at missing that obvious conclusion.
What did he tell you? Did he tell you he's innocent?
We haven't talked about the case yet. I'm easing up to that.
I expect he will.
Collins ran his thick hands through his hair, scratching loose some dandruff that fell to his shoulders.
And when he does, you'll want to believe him.
But you don't believe him.
Maybe I did. Back then.
I'm not sure. It's hard to tell with guys like Carl.
Guys like Carl? He's a pedophile, and nobody can tell a lie like a pedophile. They're the best. There's no con artist alive who can lie like a pedophile.
I looked at Collins with a blank expression that urged him to explain.
Pedophiles are the monsters walking among us. Murderers, burglars, thieves, drug dealers, they can always justify what they've done.
Most crimes occur because of simple emotions like greed or rage or jealousy.
People can understand those emotions. We don't condone it, but we understand it. Everybody's felt those feelings at one time or another. Hell, most people, if they're honest, would admit to planning a crime in their head, committing the perfect murder, getting away with it. Every person on a jury has felt angry or jealous. They understand the base emotion behind a crime like murder, and they'll punish a guy for not controlling that emotion.
I suppose so, I said.
Now, think of a pedophile. He has a passion to have sex with children. Who's going to understand that? You can't justify what you've done. There's no explanation for them. They're monsters, and they know it. Yet they can't admit it, not even to themselves. So they hide the truth, burying it so deep inside that they begin to believe their own lies.
But some can be innocent, right?
I asked. I had a guy once.
Collins leaned forward, plopping his elbows on his desk.
He was accused of perping on his 10-year-old kid. This guy had me convinced that his ex-wife planted the story in the kid's head. I mean, I believed him completely. I prepared a scathing cross-examination to tear that kid up. Then, about a month before trial, the computer forensics came back. The prosecutor called me to his office to show me a video that this dumbass made of the whole thing. Exactly what his kid said happened. When I showed the video to my client, he cried his eyes out, bawled like a frigging baby. Not because he raped this kid and got caught, but because he swore it wasn't him. The prosecutor had the son of a bitch on tape. His face, his voice, his tattoos, and he wanted me to believe it was some lookalike.
So you assume all your clients charged with pedophilia are lying?
No, not all.
Did you assume Carl was lying?
Collins paused to give my question some thought. I wanted to believe Iverson at first. I suppose I wasn't as jaded back then as I am now.
but the evidence said he killed that girl. The jury saw it, and that's why Iverson went to prison.
Is it true what they say about pedophiles in prison? I asked. That they get beat up and stuff? Collins pursed his lips and nodded.
Yeah, it's true. Prison has its own food chain. My drunk driver clients will ask, why are they picking on me? It's not like I robbed somebody. The thieves and burglars say, it's not like I killed somebody. The murderers will say, at least I'm not a pedophile. It's not like I raped a child.
Guys like Iverson have nowhere to go. There's no one worse than them. And that puts him on the bottom of that food chain. To make things worse, he did his time at Stillwater Prison. That's about as bad as it gets. I had given up trying to get comfortable in the piece of crap chair, realizing that the chair was probably uncomfortable by design, a way to encourage short office visits. I stood up and rubbed the back of my thighs. Collins also stood and walked around the desk. He picked two files out of the box and handed them to me. One was tagged jury selection, and the other was labeled sentencing.
These are ready to go, he said. I guess I can let you have the trial transcripts, too.
Trial transcripts?
Yeah, first-degree murder cases get an automatic appeal. The court reporter prepares a transcript of the trial, everything that was said, word for word. They'll have copies of that at the Supreme Court, so you can have our copy today.
Collins walked to the box and pulled out six softbound volumes, stacking them one by one in my arms, creating a pile of paper well over a foot thick.
That'll keep you busy for a while.
I looked at the books and files in my arms, feeling their weight as Mr. Collins ushered me out. I turned at the door.
What am I going to find in these books? I asked.
Collins sighed, rubbed his chin again, and shrugged.
Probably nothing you don't already know.
Chapter 11. On my bus ride home, I thumbed through the six volumes of transcripts and cursed under my breath. I had managed to create more reading for this one assignment than I had in all my other classes combined. It was too late to drop the class without screwing my GPA. My interview notes and opening chapter for Iverson's biography were due soon, this on top of all the other homework I had to do, and I could see no way to get through all this material in time. After the long trek from the bus stop to my apartment, the transcripts in my backpack seemed as heavy as stone tablets. I pulled out my keys and started to unlock my door, but paused when I heard the silk of Spanish guitar music coming from Lila's apartment. The transcripts gave me an excuse to stop in and say hi. They were, after all, her contribution to this quixotic project. Besides, I really wanted to see her again. There was something about her leave-me-the-fuck-alone attitude that hooked me. Lila answered her door, barefoot, wearing an oversized twins jersey.